Hi, this is Bob Rozakis. You're listening to the Batman Family Reunion on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Welcome to a very special episode of the Batman Family Reunion, a proud part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. My name is Paul Ken, and I'm hosting solo today since my Bat cousin, Sean M. Myers, is still hanging upside down in the Batcave. But I am super excited because I am honored to be joined tonight by none other than retired DC Comics president and publisher, longest running and best, in my opinion, writer on the Legion of Superheroes, but most importantly, at least for our Bat family anyway, the co-creator of Batman's Daughter, Helena Wayne, the Huntress. Of course, I am talking about Paul Levitz. Welcome to the reunion, Paul, and I hope you brought something good.
You know, usually I bring my students Dunkin' Donuts when they've been behaving really well. I think a little extra sugar will get them hyped up. So help yourself to a few of those.
Awesome. We take anything that's on the table. We get a big crowd here every once in a while. So I really appreciate you being here tonight. Personally, I've admired your career for many years. Not only were you a tremendously gifted writer, but you were one of the key driving forces as an editor and executive during DC's peak years, in my opinion. I've always had immense curiosity about the business side of comics, as well as loving the story. So I just want to thank you for all your contributions over the years. And so for those of you who may be listening for the first time, when we're not interviewing comic legends like Paul, our show is a read-through of Batman Family. Batman Family was a DC comic that ran for 20 issues from 1975 to 1978, and then rescued Detective Comics from the DC implosion by continuing on as a dollar comic for 15 more issues until 1980. The title started out with new features starring Batgirl and Robin, along with reprints, before morphing into all new stories starring other members of the Batman family, such as the Huntress, who we'll have a lot to say about tonight, Commissioner Gordon, Bam Bat, and even Ragman and the Demon. So, Paul, before we dive into Huntress-specific questions, I know our listeners would love to hear a little bit about your early career. So I know you were a big fan of comics growing up and started fanzines at a terribly young age. So tell us how you got started doing that and how you parlayed it into a job.
Well, you know, I had the good luck that I was born in Brooklyn at the right time. And most of us who were New York City era comic fans, kids who were probably 5 to 10 years older than I was to a couple of years younger than I was, the vast majority got a shot at working in the comic business if they really wanted it. It was a period when the industry was having real turnover of an older generation retiring. A lot of the people who'd been involved in comics since the very beginning. Towards the end of a certain period in there, it also began to expand for the first time in quite a number of years. So like a game of musical chairs in reverse, seats would open up. This kid, he's hanging around, you know, give him a job. And that happened to an awful lot of us. Some people stayed and did, you know, glorious and interesting work. People like Marv Wolfman, Len Wein, and lots of people came in for a few minutes, said, oh, this is like a real job, only doesn't pay as well. Maybe I'll go take the real job over there that mom said I ought to have. And some people from the fan generation who weren't New Yorkers who came to town to fill those seats came to New York and said, I don't want to really live here. And that opened up other seats along the way, too. For me to start, Don and Maggie Thompson were doing the best of the news fanzines when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. A magazine called Newfangles. A young married couple, they had other things to do in life. And they announced one day that they were going to end the news magazine, but they were going to end it a year out because they didn't want to return subscription money. They probably didn't hold on to the subscription money. It's a fanzine. I'm sure they were losing money on every issue. But you could subscribe for the remaining ones, and it's one of those declining things. You know, subscribe for the rest of the year, it's $1, 90 cents, 80 cents, so on to the end. And my buddy Paul Kupperberg and I are sitting around my house, and it's like, we're not going to know what's going on. Publishers in those days didn't go to any effort to tell anybody anything. There weren't anything equivalent to what exists on the web today. So we threw together $16 and started our own fanzine, made a couple of calls to Marvel and DC to see what we could squeeze out of them. And built it from there.
Fantastic.
In that period, we're talking about the early 1970s, pretty much the whole comics industry in America was New York centric. Mm-hmm. And it was very small. There were maybe, I think, something like 200 creative people in the whole field. So by doing a fanzine like that, we got to know everybody. Some people became close personal friends. Other people were just sort of used to seeing us around. And that opened doors.
I hear stories about just taking the tour at DC or just walking up. Back then, there's no security, right? You just walked into the offices and they say, hey, kid.
But if they were used to seeing you, it was not much of a big deal.
Your first job was at 16, is that right? Writing letter columns for Joe Orlando?
Yeah, I'm still a high school senior.
That's amazing. You know, I recently read Paul Kupperberg, you mentioned in his book, Direct Conversations. I get that on the Kickstarter. And he told Joe Orlando, hey, I'm not a writer. I'm quoting that right. So how did you get started writing?
So I started doing the letter columns for Joe. He didn't think you had to be much of a writer to write a letter column, which is probably pretty fair editorial judgment. But I guess I did okay at that. And his then assistant, Michael Fleischer, was going to take the whole summer off. He either had an academic project he was working on or this was going to goof off. And Joe asked me if I would fill in. Yeah, this is tough. So the day after I finished high school, I was on the masthead of DC as an assistant editor at 16 years old. Michael never came back and I never left.
This now gets us in. You were assistant editor on some books and one of them was All-Star Comics at that point, or was it a little bit later?
That's a couple of years later when Jerry Conway is hired at DC and I start assisting him as well as Joe.
I see. Because then Jerry left and this is how you got to be the writer. So walk us through that. So you were assisting Jerry, who is both the writer and the editor. Is that, do I have that right?
So Jerry came to DC late 74, maybe early 75.
Big deal at that point, right? I mean, he was a known creator, right?
I was one of the first meaningful Marvel creators to come to DC besides Kirby.
Right.
Jack obviously was the home run and all of that a few years before. And he was a very young hire for DC's editorial staff, which was nearly geriatric at that point. Jerry was asked to launch a whole host of books, one of them being All-Star.
Right.
Came up with as a suggestion and got signed off on. He wasn't a deep fan of the old Justice Society stuff.
Okay.
So I was useful on that because that was one of the things that had fascinated me as a fan and I had done some research on. And
got so you were like his resource for, you know, what would Wildcat do or something?
A little bit. And, you know, he was very close with Roy Thomas, who knows the material far better than I ever did.
Right.
So Roy was certainly a real coach to him in the process.
Yeah, because one of the things we do on our show is we look at the ads from the time and talk about that, and we have a good time with that. And there were several of them, you know, Conway's Corner, and it was some of the first ones we could remember where, other than Kirby, as you said, where the creative team was really prominently featured in the ads, I think.
Well, the culture was shifting in the whole industry at that point.
Yeah.
Credits, which had been spotty at DC, become common at Marvel, almost non-existent everywhere else in the field, were becoming more normal. The world was changing, partly because it was a different generation of people starting to work in the offices and saying, hey, why don't we do this? Partly, I don't know, it's just something in the overall culture of the country.
Right.
Anyway, after about a year and a half, whatever it was, Jerry got the offer to be the editor-in-chief of Marvel.
Right.
And left to do that. It was not a job he was ultimately suited for.
He didn't last very long doing that,
three whole weeks. But look, if you're not suited for something, it's good to figure it out fast.
Yeah, more power to him to know that so quickly, right?
At any rate, that created the opportunity for a number of us to pick up books as editors and for me to go full-time. I was still going to the office part-time at that point.
And you were in college at this point?
Yeah, I was cramming all my courses into a couple days a week and coming up to DC the other days.
I see. So that brings us to The Huntress. So she appeared concurrently in All-Star 69 and DC Superstars number 17. So I always found that interesting that a week, or I don't know how long they were in between the two, but they were same month, right?
Same day.
Same day, yeah. And I bought them both off the stand, so it was pretty cool. How was that? Like, how did you decide to, like, what was the impetus for that sort of rollout of this new character? Is anticipated to be a big deal or what?
I don't know that anything was a big deal at that point. The shape comics were in. Fandom was a fairly small part of the audience at that point. It was fun. You know, it was an opportunity. Oh, well, we're going to bring this new character in. But instead of having to stop the story in All-Star and devote a lot of space or not tell the story at all, tell it in two balloons or something, we can
have a whole story.
Pull this off, be in two places at once.
In the Superstars issue, there's a panel near the end. It's at Selena's funeral. And Helena is like standing really strong and proud. And Bruce is really down and despondent. It still got me today. It's like a lot of that, I assume you had some direction, but a lot of that's Joe Staton, right? I mean, tell me about your collaboration with him, as well as Bob Layton, in the creation of Helena and how it all went down and working with those guys going after that.
Other people's memories are better than mine, but basically we started off saying we only have Power Girl in the book. It would be nice to get another woman in here. It would improve the dynamic. Maybe we do a new Batgirl. And that morphed the idea of doing the Huntress. Tony Collin had something to do with it as well. He was one of the company colorists and assistant production manager and another old comics fan.
Yeah.
And a big Green Lantern fan, so he was familiar with the Huntress character. And it just sort of morphed from there. You know, I had a lot of wonderful collaborations with Joe. He remains a good friend.
Mm-hmm.
Bob remains a friend. And Bob always was unusual for an inker in the business, in that he was always a guy with ideas and story thoughts. He'd go on to do a lot of co-plotting at Marvel.
Yeah, I mean, his run with Iron Man was terrific. I remember that when that was coming out when I was a kid, really enjoying that too. So he was like, you're co-plotting. I don't know if he was actually writing dialogue and stuff. I don't know.
Yeah, I think something like that.
Yeah. And how the name Huntress? I mean, other than the link to the old Golden Age villain.
Combination of things. One, we had a Batgirl in the universe. One of the things I really liked about Jerry's choice of doing Power Girl, coming up with the character, besides the personality texture that he gave her, was giving her a distinct name. So she
wasn't another Supergirl, right?
Okay, so we're not going to call her Batgirl. What are we going to call her? Well, what is she? You know, Batman very much is a hunter. One of the theorists, I think came out of fandom originally, not The Office, but might have been one of the guys in The Office, came up with the saying that sort of ultimately Superman is a fireman and Batman's a cop. Superman comes in when there's the grand disaster. Batman's walking the beat.
Mm-hmm.
He's patrolling. He's walking it on the tops of rooftops.
Mm-hmm.
But he's...
Unless Bob Haney wrote it, right?
Bob had his great days and his less great days, but
love them.
Fabulous career.
Love the stuff. Sorry, I interrupted you. Sorry.
It's okay. Anyway, so who is she? Well, she is in fact the Huntress. And particularly that went well to coming up with the crossbow.
Yeah. Crossbows are great. I mean, no other character. I mean, you had Green Arrow, of course, but
it gave her a distinctive look and it gave her a distinctive ambiance, for lack of a better word. You know, she wasn't just there to punch people out. She was on the hunt. Watch the hell out if she's after you.
So she joined the JSA pretty immediately. A lot of her, in the first few issues, a lot of her interactions were with Wildcat and the Star Spangled Kid. I just really read these the other day. Were they favorites of yours? Was there a particular reason? Were they just because they were non-powered or no recollection at all? It was just like for the first two issues, they were the ones she was with and she confessed to them who she was and all that stuff.
Whatever seemed to be working that day.
Yeah. Okay.
Sometimes the characters write themselves.
One you may remember better or have more of to say, the friendship with Power Girl. I always thought that was cool. You were also pretty much at the same time writing the Power Girl showcase issues. Was it part of the plan all along for them to be buddies like the old Batman and Superman? Like, what was your inspiration or thought process behind that?
Well, I mean, part of it was certainly the mirror of Superman and Batman, but part of it was these were both strong women, but they were very different strong women.
Mm-hmm.
As a writer, one of the things that I look to define a character is what their life experience is. And Power Girls was so weird, so asocial. And Helena, in many ways, was really the first in the DC universe to be a true second generation.
Right.
You know, Robin, Kid Flash, Aqualad all joined their mentor at puberty, roughly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, kind of in their prime. Yeah, the mentors in the prime and they were kids. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Helen is sitting there day one in her crib and daddy's making her do push-ups. God knows what the hell mom was making her do, probably pick dad's pocket. Not that they necessarily wanted her to be a superhero or a jewel thief, certainly. But you had these incredibly smart, incredibly powerful parents who wanted this person to be the best they could be. You had an amazing genetic heritage. Who would that person turn out to be? She'd be something pretty damn cool.
Pretty special, yeah.
And much more secure in a lot of ways and much more centered as a person than Power Girl could be.
Yeah, she was always very confident. That was an appealing part of her character, for sure. Again, around the same time, sort of interspersed with those All-Star issues, that's when the Batman family story started. And the very first one that Jerry and Bob Rozakis wrote, there was an issue 17, actually just recorded about that issue, but it's coming out after this one, Will, where she goes over to Earth One. And this is like her, I don't know, fourth or fifth appearance. Any thoughts about her meeting her Uncle Bruce so early in her career? I mean, because it didn't really talk about it back in her strip. On the crossovers they did, but Jerry wrote most of that, I think.
I always thought those would be just incredibly spooky moments.
Yeah.
You've lost your parent and they're walking up to you and they're also 20 years too young.
Because in that very issue, there was a story and Bob Rozakis wrote it where she faces off along with Batwoman and Batgirl with Catwoman of Earth One and Poison Ivy. She was just taken aback, which was pretty nice moments in the book. So that's cool. The other thing that was established in at least the first three stories from the next three issues of Batman Family was that Helena was a lawyer. And specifically, she was in this thing called the Public Interest Research Firm, okay, which sounded like a pro bono kind of firm. But I thought it was really interesting, and this was seemed to be all you. She was debating whether she was doing everything she could for Gotham City. So what was your thought process there? What was your inspiration for that?
Well, I think that was probably the job that her parents encouraged her into.
Oh, that's interesting.
I've always thought of Bruce Wayne and his father as being Theodore Roosevelt Sr. and Theodore Roosevelt, who becomes president. Senior was probably the driving force in New York City charity. He helped set up the Museum of Natural History. He helped set up what's called the Children's Aid Society, which is one of our really great urban institutions. And Junior, of course, goes into politics, is a very establishment figure, and then comes home one day. And on the same day, his wife dies in childbirth, and his mother, who he loved dearly, dies the same day. And he freaks out, runs off to the Dakota Badlands, toughens himself up, plays vigilante there, maybe in many ways. Comes back to New York as the police commissioner, and he's riding around the city of New York on a bicycle at night, waking up sleeping cops. That, to me, is the story of Bruce Wayne and his father. Well, if you assume that, then there's a natural flip in the next generation to a synthesis of that, to say, all right, dear, I don't know that you should go out and get yourself shot every day. That would really make Mother and I kind of nervous. But you can make a difference in the world, and you don't have to make a great living. You can do things for public service.
Right.
That's enormously rewarding, and it's very rewarding to the parent. My daughter is not a lawyer, but she's a executive in the public health area and worked in not-for-profits exclusively in her life, making the world a better place on a very daily basis, in many cases really on the front line of some important services. And it's great to watch. You know, it is being a hero. So I think they might have encouraged her in that path. She was so smart that I made some remark that I vaguely recall in the narration in one of those stories about how young she was of becoming a partner.
Yeah, she was like a partner right out of law school. It was some of that stuff that doesn't, quote, really happen, but it doesn't matter. This is the DC universe, right?
Right. I don't know if you can buy your way into a partnership. It can
be maybe.
I mean, this wasn't like a giant commercial law firm.
Right, right.
But Daddy donates an extra $10 billion and
which one of the characters there gave her a hard time about, which I thought was great.
There's parts of it that are plausible. And I have, a dear friend of my generation who's been a public interest lawyer for most of her career, working on Title IX issues and things like that. That probably was an influence as well. She was probably starting to do that at that point, or I was aware of it.
I'm going to step away from Huntress just briefly for one question, because it was about this time that you wrote a story that my co-host, Sean, is his favorite all-time story. And this is the Starlight, Star Bright, Farthest Star I See Tonight from DC Special Series, number 21, 1979, for those reading along at home. In his opinion, a huge part of the appeal of that story was it tells how different groups can come together, not only to coexist, but to make each other's lives better. Do you have any recollections about your inspirations for that story?
Len gave me the opportunity to do a Christmas story, which I thought would be cute, doing a future version. Of course, the Legion was a diverse group, so there was a natural opportunity there.
Okay. Is that the story, hopefully Sean doesn't come in, is that the story where you find out that Colossal Boy is Jewish?
Yep.
Yeah, that's what I thought. That's a great one, too. I like to read a lot of the Christmas stories and holiday stories all around that time of year, and that's always one of the ones I pull, too.
Like my most reprinted story.
Is it really? Yeah, that's great. Again, when I was a kid, I loved all these, going off script here a little bit, but I loved all those anthology slash weirdly titled books that DC had. DC Special, DC Special Series. You never knew what you were going to get when you walked to the newsstand.
When they were good, they were very, very good. When they were bad, yeah, let's just watch that.
So back to Huntress. I'm not going to ask you much about DC implosion, because that would get us a whole 2-hour podcast just for that. That was a big deal. Although I would recommend, I don't know if you've read the book that came out from Tomorrow's a couple of years ago.
I lived it.
You lived it. You didn't need to read that book. Fair enough. But can you talk about your role? The famous story, of course, and we even reference it in our little blurb, is that the company was going to cancel Detective Comics and Batman Family was selling better. And the idea was come bring them together. Then after that, you had Detective Comics starring the Batman Family. Can you talk just a little bit about that series of events and your role there?
Well, the context is that the winter of 78 into 79 was a horrible winter. The newsstand comic book business had been shrinking and shrinking and was suffering regardless. But that winter was catastrophic for it. And because of the way that returnable comics move through the pipeline, because of the dynamic of that winter where many shipments did not get out to the places they were supposed to go and simply went back immediately, it even looked worse than it was. And it was pretty damn bad in reality. So the estimates that were coming into the company were really horrible. I thought the math that the distribution guys were running for their estimates was a little bit off, but you know, I was a punk ass kid of 21. Nobody was going to listen to me. So we were given effectively a set of economic guidelines, come up with a budget that does this, this, or this, and then come up with a plan that fulfills it. And I spent, I remember it being a month, it may have been longer, coming up with different variations of how many monthlies, how many bi-monthlies, how many dollar comics, will this add up to the right thing? Will this be too much? How many pages will this be? Well, if we do this plan, do we have enough work for everybody we've got contracts out to? Who do we have to fire? Who do we have to lay off? Horrible, horrible month.
Terrible.
But we came up with a workable plan that didn't injure too many of the creative people too much and kept the heart of the line alive for the fans. The detective story that you mentioned, you know, Mike Gold gets a lot of credit for being the one who made the suggestion of preserving detective that way. I should have figured that out, but I didn't. All points to Mike on it.
Brilliant.
Smart man.
But you got through it.
We juggled through it.
And the dollar comics were pretty popular at this point, right? We love them. Fans, we love them.
They were doing better on some levels than the smaller ones. You know, again, nothing was doing well. This was not a good time for comics. The newsstand model was fading away. And the direct business was starting to be meaningful for Marvel, but not really meaningful for anybody else.
Interesting.
We weren't putting out a lot of product that would be interesting to a serious comic fan.
So after Batman Family, quote, rescued Detective Comics, the Huntress did not appear in Detective. There was ample room, the Demon, the Human Target, a bunch of other types of characters. You know, were you too busy with your day job? Was there not the appetite? Because she was still in Venture Comics and the JSA and stuff like that.
In the book, so theoretically I couldn't write it if I put it in there.
Oh, so interesting. So you were editing Detective at the time. Got it. Interesting. At that time, she was appearing, like I said, in Adventure as a JSA member, and she was in all the crossovers, which Jerry Conway wrote. Could you tell that Huntress was pretty popular? She was appeared in all of them. But you didn't really have a metric for that, as I know you've talked before about inventing a lot of metrics over the years.
In the newsstand business, you had very little ability to measure the popularity of a character who didn't have their own comic on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
You could theorize if an issue jumped and that character was the primary character on the cover, but that certainly wouldn't have been the case in All-Star or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Never got around to doing a Huntress showcase or anything.
Right.
Did people write a lot of nice letters? Did people shake your hand more at the comic convention? Maybe, but what did that represent for the overall audience? The older guys, the Bob Haneys of the world, really had the attitude of, you know, these fans are, they're nice enough human beings, but they're loud voices that don't represent what the real audience is. And there's some truth to that, because the real audience that made the economic difference at that point were 10, 12-year-old kids,
right,
too young to be at the comic conventions, too young to be writing, you know, long letters of analysis. Bob wasn't entirely wrong. He wasn't entirely right. But it was a transitional period as we were fading out of one business model and into another.
At the same time, there was, and this you did write, the decision to kill Batman off in Venture and being killed off by a nobody, which obviously became a story point with the Joker later on, which I thought was brilliant. Any pushback at that time, or it was just...
It was a story, you know. We didn't remember, comics fandom was tiny.
Mm-hmm.
The best-selling direct titles going through the comic shops were selling maybe, for DC, 10 or 15,000 copies compared to selling 100,000 copies on the newsstand. It wasn't a world like now where the minute something happens, you've got every message board, every internet troll is out there announcing, oh my God, you did that? You should be killed.
Had to wait till Superman died for that, right?
A little bit after, you say.
So the decision was eventually made to have her have a backup in Wonder Woman. Was anything else considered? She never got her own book. Was it just, hey, this is our top female characters, put her in that?
You know, I don't remember much about what was going on then. My workload had been adjusted because of the implosion.
Mm-hmm.
I gave up the Legion. The first priority was to take care of the contract people. So I had been bouncing around doing, I did a couple of Lois Lane stories for Superman Family. I did a couple of mystery stories at that point.
Picked up what you could, right?
I was doing the Superman newspaper strip, which was one of the more profitable assignments in the house. So I had no right to complain very much. But I, you know, my workload kept changing. And at some point, Len gave me the opportunity to do a Huntress strip. It may have been his idea to put her in the back of Wonder Woman. Or it may have been we were at lunch and he said, you know, I want to put something in the back of Wonder Woman. I want something there beyond what we're doing in the front. And I may have tossed the idea out, but more likely him.
Got it. In those stories, you brought back the Joker, Robin, Alfred. You know, any favorite moments or regrets from that, those particular stories?
The favorite moment was just, you know, we were having fun.
One infamous moment I have to ask you about when Dick and Helena, quote, notice each other. When I was a kid, I was like, huh, I hadn't thought of that before, but they're not really related, even though they had to have grown up somewhat. But he was older, you know, he was probably almost out of the house by the time she was born, I would think, right?
You know, you're talking to somebody whose paternal grandmother and grandfather were brought up in the same house.
Oh, okay.
Their parents were a second marriage, and it was a blended family.
There you go.
They were engaged in, it was then Russia, these days it would be Lithuania, and grandpa emigrated here first, and grandma followed about a year later, and he was ready to follow up on the engagement, and she was, no, it's a new country. I'm going to check it out for a while first. About a year later, she decided, all right, you'll do.
That's awesome. But Helena did have a regular love interest. Harry was his name. Yeah. And he finds out in the course of those stories her secret identity, which, again, didn't happen every day in the Bronze Age. And Helena even makes a comment, I wrote it down. Never in 40 years did Dad ever let anybody find out his ID. And again, it didn't happen another time. How did you sort of think to have that happen and make him more of a partner that way?
You know, I guess I was slightly more modern in the assumption of what the romantic relationship was likely to be. I don't remember whether I believed that at that point they were sleeping together or not. But if you're really close to somebody, the fact that they're putting on a funny costume, the voice is too distinctive and there's a limit to what you can disguise. Certainly her costume doesn't disguise very much compared to Batman's. You know, those old Silver Age stories where, you know, they put Alfred in the Batman costume for a few minutes with some padding. Sort of do that with a Batman costume. You can't do that with a Huntress costume.
We notice Alfred in that costume pretty quick, I think.
Yeah. You know, you take one look. Is there a mole on her somewhere or something distinctive?
No, I thought that was great. It holds up. It definitely reads more modern than a lot of the stories at that time, which is pretty cool.
But it was a transitional moment. And I had the good luck overall as a writer to be in tune with what was about to happen because of my fan background, maybe, as my personal taste as a reader. Not so much on the Huntress stuff, although I guess a little bit there, but certainly the Legion stuff that I got recognized for. A lot of it wasn't so much that the stories were in and of themselves extraordinary, but they were stories of a sort that Marvel had started to do. Not all Marvel titles by any stretch of the imagination at that point, but DC had done almost none of. It felt more like what was emerging as the taste for the comic shop. So for a minute or two there, I was one of the flavors of the day. Never before and never again.
I don't know about that. So you moved on from the Huntress after number 296. There was that big crossover with all the female heroes that you, I think, co-wrote with Roy Thomas, right?
Yeah, I brought it in Roy dialogue, I think.
Yeah. And then you moved on and Joey Cavallari came on and took over the Huntress and Roy basically took over all the Earth 2 stuff. Were you too busy for your day job or had you said everything you wanted to say with the Huntress?
We were moving into crisis. Mm-hmm. So she wasn't going to, my Huntress wasn't going to be around very long.
So you knew that even then? Because I know that Crisis took a couple of years to just come to fruition.
I think so. And by then, maybe I had taken on the Legion and that was all I could handle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you were pretty exclusive Legion for quite a while after that. And I assumed that your corporate duties also started to increase at that time.
It's not so much that the duties increased. I was doing, like most of the people, I was doing the freelance outside the office, mostly on weekends. Mm-hmm. There was a limited amount of work to go around. And it was not appropriate for me, since I had a role in dividing the loot, to be greedy.
Got it.
Once I was in a position of a certain level, I said, look, I'll stick with doing the one book a month of the Legion or the whatever ties to that in the process once in a while, it's like Cosmic Boy miniseries or something. But I'm not taking any paying work away from anybody else.
So you mentioned Crisis and really no way to salvage the pre-existing Helena Wayne was the end of Crisis. The character seemed to remember for a little bit and then that all went away. But was there any conversation about keeping her around in any other capacity other than creating the new hero, which we'll get to in a sec?
Now figure out somebody else who can go in the suit, Joey.
And so any thoughts, we won't spend long on Helena Bertinelli, but she was Huntress for a long time. I mean, any thoughts on her? You never actually wrote her, I don't think. Is that correct?
It depends.
Okay.
The Huntress miniseries,
New 52,
years later, started out as a Helena Bertinelli miniseries when I plotted it. That was why I set it in Italy. It was structured for that. Between the time that I began plotting it and the time it was a finished piece of work, Dan changed his mind and wanted it to be a Helena Wayne story. Okay, I can make that work, sort of.
Fascinating, because I was going to ask about that, because that's the New 52. It was a request from Dan to do that, Dan DiDio. And so then it led into World's Finest, World's apostrophe Finest, that you wrote. That sort of came later, the realization of Helena Wayne.
Yeah.
Fascinating. In this case, you know, as we find out in the World's Finest series, she was Robin first. Wasn't clear that there was a Dick Grayson or not. Your thoughts on the success of how that all went down? I mean, I know it was a tumultuous time.
I mean, I really enjoyed that origin story where they were kids. I've got a page of it hanging behind me along the the origin page of Huntress by Joe.
Cool.
Getting to work with George, getting to work with Kevin Maguire.
Yeah, it was a good-looking book.
Wonderfully talented guys. And both really good guys at making personality come through the characters.
Mm-hmm.
That was a buddy book. Not quite a buddy comedy, but buddy dramedy, maybe.
Well, you were able to give them both really distinct personalities. Kara was the free spirit, and Helena was keeping her in check, but they're trying to find a way home, which, you know.
And again, who are you, right? If you were brought up in a locked-up environment like that spaceship routine that we posited for Kara, you were either going to be a horribly screwed up introvert or a horribly screwed up extrovert coming out. You know, she was a very out there girl, probably in modern terms, very sex positive. And Helena was determined to be herself, didn't need anybody. Liked men, liked sex, I would assume, but only if she could be in charge, only if it was on her terms. And it was a measured part of her life in a different way. So what happens if you got two of those people who are really, really terrific, intimate friends? How do you match them together, and where are the points of friction?
We have a couple of miscellaneous things, but any parting thoughts about the Huntress in general that you want to make?
I never would have believed she'd still be around. There's a Birds of Prey TV series poster on the wall back there somewhere.
Yeah, I noticed that.
She showed up in the Harley movie.
Yeah.
More Joey's version than my version, but still some of the personality flows through from the original. It's just wonderful seeing a kid still around and grow up so nicely.
That's awesome. On our show, we just have a good time talking about this stuff, but we're all revisiting the stuff that we liked a lot when we were kids, and it's just fun to talk about that. I'm going to ask a couple of miscellaneous things. So one of my favorites that you wrote was the origin of the Justice Society in DC Special number 29. I mean, I love that comic. A lot of concepts in there, you know, the Spear of Destiny, the abandoned invasion of England, Adam jumping in front and saving FDR. I mean, just a lot of great moments in that. I don't know that that's been reprinted very often, but it's been in the All-Star compilations. I guess it's in there. I'd have to go look at my book on the shelf.
In a couple of versions of that, it was in a digest reprint at one point. And then Roy's version of it, when he readapted it, has been around and used a couple of times. It's my favorite story of the stuff that I wrote back in the day.
You actually signed my copy of it right over there. You and Joe Staten, I got signed that at a show years ago. One of my prize things up on my spinner rack there. So I really did.
Great fun together. I mean, some of those concepts I borrowed. Englehart had done a wonderful Weird War Tales around the Spear of Destiny.
Oh, I wasn't aware of that. I'll have to look that up.
I learned about it that way. I was an assistant editor on that book. To my mind, once we decided we were going to do the origin of the JSA, you had some questions you had to answer. What brings them together? But also, why don't they just go and kill Hitler or drag him back and throw him in whatever prison? So I needed something, and that pretty much meant it had to be magic and it had to be pretty powerful magic. Okay. A lot of my skill as a writer, certainly in those years, was about taking things within the DC universe that existed and mirroring them or saying, well, if it's that, then it must be this, pulling those things together in that kind of fashion. And then it was just a hoot, whether it was getting FDR in there or Stevenson, the man called Intrepid. I had just finished the book, The Man Called Intrepid, the story of his life. The time I was writing that story, plotting that story.
Well, it's well-paced, too. You've got the first with Green Lantern and Flash and Batman, and then the other heroes come in and Dr. Fate, and then Superman comes in big at the end to stop the missile. It's just a well-paced out story, right? Terrific, terrific story. A little more modern. Another thing I really enjoyed more recently, you did 18 issues on Dr. Fate and you introduced Khaled. Yeah, it was really neat reimagining. How did you come up with that? I know you wrote a Dr. Fate origin way back in,
yeah,
I wrote it down, DC Special Series number 10 in 1978, but obviously this is a totally different character.
Well, at that point I was under contract with DC for a certain number of pages a month.
Okay.
Part of the transition of moving out from the desk. And my assignments had lapsed. I think maybe that was when World's Finest was ending or something. And I sit down with Dan and Jim. What do you want me to do? The company had just done some kind of marketing analysis that said, well, our audience is aging. We need some younger characters because that'll attract younger readers. And we want to be a little more diverse, both in our characters and in our art styles. We've got too many people doing Jim Lee style work.
Oh, the art was terrific in that book.
So I started to run through the list of grand old names that I didn't think were being used. Nah, this one's got that. This one's got that. Nobody's using Dr. Fate. Great. I love Dr. Fate. Let me see what I can come up with. Go home. Think about the character. Well, he's Egyptian origin. Kent discovers the helmet in the Egyptian tomb. But we've never done much with Egyptian. We could make him more diverse, make the kid Egyptian American. Okay, that could be fun. That could be some stuff to screw around with.
Made him a real doctor.
Made him a med student.
Med student, right. Med student.
That comes from, you know, I was teaching kids that age. One of my children was still young. I thought about what the life of young people was in that generation. I certainly was no longer one of them. And I really felt that they were incredibly stressed and overwhelmed. It's a much tougher generation growing up than it was for me. Okay, who's the most overwhelmed? Pre-med, the toughest possible academics on top of the social pressures and everything else, the drug pressures and things like that are going on in society. And it really struck me that the mood to strike for was what Stan and Steve had done on the early Spider-Mans with Peter. So that was my emotional role model. I had met Sonny Liu years before, but I had run into him again relatively recently when I had been in Singapore as a guest of honor at a convention there. So I remembered him and I suggested him as the artist. And Dan and Jim took a look at the work and said, yeah, this is a little different. This would be cool. And Sonny was available. And that was wonderful because he's so goddamn smart, so wonderfully talented, and so distinctive as a creative person. So we had a lot of fun.
Yeah, great series. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was one of the highlights at that sort of time period coming out. I really enjoyed it. Another random question. I squeezed this one in. You created two different characters with Steve Ditko. The Stalker, way early in your career, and then the Prince Gavin version of Starman. Lots of stories out there about Steve Ditko. How was your relationship with him? How did you find working with him? I mean, I know he just would come in and drop stuff off. Did you get to talk to him much? Tell us about that.
We got along fine. He's a wonderfully talented man, one of the greats of the field. I delight in the fact that we got to do 20-odd stories together. We did that. We also did the story for Mike Friedrich's Imagine.
I know he did Legion for a while, but you probably were not writing at the time he was doing it. That's an in-between time.
Yeah, no, Chuck Harris suckered him into doing a couple of issues of Legion, which was not great casting, I think, on any basis.
Yeah. Talk, if you don't mind, about your giant book from Tashin, The 75 Years of DC Comics, The Art of Modern Mythmaking is the official title. I don't have the big one, but I have the three, like a Golden Age, Silver Age, Bronze Age versions. How did that come about? I mean, they're tremendously interesting books.
Well, we were coming up on our 75th anniversary, and we wanted to do a publishing program related to it. Cheryl Rubin, who was our head of licensing in those years, Steve Corte, who was head editor for the licensed publishing work, had solicited proposals from a number of different publishers for doing the program. Ultimately, we signed off on one from Tashin. They began work on the book, and this is, I was still on the desk.
So 2008,
2009? Yeah, somewhere in there. And Josh Baker, who was one of their wonderful art directors, was accumulating the material. He found ways to, a great collector named Ian Levine in England, who had a literally complete DC collection. They went over there and talked to him into letting him photograph the books the way they wanted to. And you know, Benedict Tashin and his team produce extraordinarily beautiful books.
It's unbelievable how beautiful they are.
They really don't work like anyone else. So they're accumulating all of this raw material, and Steve's trying to find someone to write the text material. And the announcement comes that I'm getting up from the desk, and Steve comes walking in the office. Well, from anybody, Paul, and you really know this stuff. You're probably the only one who can get it done on deadline at this point. What about it? And, you know, it was a wonderful opportunity for me because it really reminded people that I was a writer in a way that just taking on a couple of comics a month didn't. One in Eisner, which I had not had the opportunity to do with anything I had written before. There weren't Eisner Awards when I was a writer who might have won one. I don't know that I would have, but at least I'd have been in the game.
Right.
The second incarnation of when I was writing, when I got up from the desk, no chance in hell that I was going to be able to. So much more out there that was better than what I was doing. So it was a hoot. And then you know, they were going to fillet it originally into five. They ended up doing three of the five. Unfortunately, the market didn't support it enough to allow them to finish the series. But we added a little material, did some fun interviews, won a bunch of awards, US, overseas, and just had great fun with it.
Before I'm going to let you go, I want to do a quick set of lightning round questions. Do your best. Because again, this is the Batman Family Reunion. The first one is, who is your favorite Bat family member other than the Huntress?
You know, I guess I still have to lean to Batman himself.
Perfectly fine answer. How about your favorite Justice Society member other than the Huntress?
Fate or Power Girl.
Favorite Legion member?
That depends on whose life I was screwing up. When I was a kid, it was Timberwolf, Lone Wolf in his original incarnation. It was a period when I was really fond of Element Lad. Uh-huh. You know, mostly it was whoever's life I was really playing with at the time.
Very cool. How about your favorite non-standard DC Comics format? Digest, tabloid size, dollar comics. DC was experimenting with lots of formats in the 70s and 80s. Original graphic novels like when Dark Knight and Watchmen came out. What was your favorite non-standard DC Comics format?
Well, I mean, clearly it was the prestige kind of format.
Dark Knight format?
Was what hit both the creative and commercial heights.
Okay.
I had a fondness for the tabloids as a really fun product, particularly for younger people. And I think we did some beautiful ones along the way. I'm proud of the work I did as an editor on a bunch of them, some credited, some uncredited.
And for those who are listening, we have another show on the network. Treasury Cast is called, both Marvel and DC, giant size comics. How about your favorite non-DC character?
Maybe The Vision.
The Vision. Very cool. All right. And then your proudest achievement, first as an executive and then as a creator. Proudest achievement during your time at DC. That's a long time. It's 50 years.
Yeah, I can't single down to a single one. I mean, as an executive, it's a combination of being an important part of the team that figured out how to create creator equities and royalties and systems that did two things. One, it made the creators' lives better, but it made the business better. That's really the pivot that brings us to the creative revival that happened in comics in the 80s.
Yep.
Without that, we don't get there. Would some of the little independents have gotten to the same place? Absolutely. But they didn't have the market power to affect the creative community in the same way. It was DC, and because DC did it,
Marvel had to do it.
Marvel to follow pretty much immediately, that really changed the economics of the creative community.
I figured you were going to say that, because that's a good legacy to have.
And then the body of work that we did between 85 and, say, 95, really making the graphic novel format a dominant thing in the United States as we set it up and defined it. There had been trade paperback collections of comics before, mm-hmm. but there had never been ones that were done sequentially other than one volume of Jack Katz's Lost Kingdom. And that was not particularly successful. But what we were able to do, particularly with Sandman, really set the model for how graphic novels would, and how comics, therefore, would be packaged and marketed for the next 25 years.
Finally, after all these years, after 50 years, how does it feel to write a Marvel story? Tell everybody about Avengers War Across Time.
It was great fun. You know, I loved the work of both companies when I was a kid. Avengers was a comic that I learned a lot from. It was part of what was a major influence on my work on both Justice Society and Legion. Stan, Jack were friends. Don Heck was a guy I worked with a lot. Dick Ayers, who worked on those early issues, was a guy I worked with a lot and liked. To get to do an homage to them and play in their world was a hoot and a half. It gave me an excuse to reread all the early Marvels, to make all my notes. I think I spent something like 80% of what I've made on it on Alan Davis's art so far.
A beautiful book. It's a lot of fun, too.
Working with Alan was a delight. I mean, he's such a talented man. I've never had a chance to work with him creatively before. And people are actually reading it and enjoying it. I was really spoiled in my career as a writer in the 80s because I was writing one of the books that people talked about. Chris was clearly the number one selling writer in the business by far. Marv with Teen Titans was ahead of me at DC. Not going to ever put myself in class with Frank or Alan as artists. I was the solid A-minus hitter coming and playing cleanup.
Pick up a Legion book and it was always a good read.
And people paid attention. I took 20 years off from writing to play with my kids as they were growing up. You know, I was making perfectly good money running the company, so I didn't need the extra money. When I came back to writing solidly in 10, some of it was good. All of it, I think, was professional, but none of it was the state of the art. Nobody much was talking about it. You know, once in a while. And some of the stuff I did that I'm fondest of, like Brooklyn Blood, which I did for Dark Horse, just vanished in the haze. So much being published these days. And that's the market, and that's how the world works. That's fine. I understand it better than most, having been a publisher for 100 years. But as a writer, they don't love me. The Warner Brothers execs used to tease me before San Diego Con that I was going down there and I was going to be a rock star. And I said, no, you don't understand. What I am is I'm a doo-wop guy at a rock event. And I used to be cool. You know, Avengers actually got reviewed a bunch of places and people liked it for what it was.
Yeah. You
know, seems to have sold pretty well for the shops, which is probably the best selling thing I've done in a bunch of years now.
That's terrific.
So that's a delightful feeling. And it's pretty. And I got to write a mark about it.
That's awesome. Yeah, no, it's super fun. So wrapping up, any message? We have a lot of Bronze Age fans, obviously, listen to this podcast. Any message to them as they go back and read their old Batman Family comics?
Thank you for letting me get away with it. A lot of us had a lot of fun. You mentioned Bob before. At least in those years, I think he'd managed to put together a full, complete collection of Batman back to number one. Mine does not go back that far. Mine starts at 100. We were doing stuff we really wanted to do. We were doing stuff that captured our own childhoods. We did some of it well. We did some of it less well. We were learning on the job, but we did it all with spirit. And the people who are listening to the podcast who were there at the time, who were picking up the books one by one, were letting us get away with it. Thank you.
Paul, thank you so much for being on our show. Any other appearances or anything else other than the Avengers book you want to plug? Any top secret thing you're working on you can give us a scoop on?
Debating what my next writing project is, was busy wrestling with a publisher this morning to see if we could work out some kind of reasonable arrangement on it.
Okay.
I do a lot of teaching. If you're the right age, come enroll at Pace University, take a few courses with me, graduate and undergraduate level, Columbia every couple of years. I'm not doing a lot of conventions right now. I'm not feeling I have a target on my back from COVID anymore, but not in a great rush to be with 100,000 people.
I understand that.
We're getting there. The world is returning. I've been to some sizable events already and come back intact. And I've had plenty of friends who've been to the conventions and have been fine.
Thanks again for being on our show. I appreciate it greatly. You're an inspiration to all of us. So we really, really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for keeping people interested in the books.
All right, take care.